Leadership and Innovation.
Thank you. So I have to find my presentation. Is it here or here?
It's right there, yes.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to Philip and Clement for whatever year this is. I think this is 2022. I lose track of the, I used to only lose track of the days, now I lose track of the years, so I don't know if that's a sign of a progress or something. In any case, thank you. It's wonderful to visit Austria. This is my first international conference in 2 years. I feel like I'm a virgin again, in terms of so I feel very rejuvenated, but thank you. So I'm going to talk about this paper that I worked on for a conference at Helsinki and for a conference volume there, which I presented through Zoom a few months ago. And so I'm looking forward to developing this in many different directions. But it's looking at the notion of crisis. I feel a little bit silly talking about crisis now, since I think I see only one or two masks out there, so we must be post-crisis. But certainly we have the benefit of experience to understand this notion of crisis and how it shapes our understanding of innovation. My thesis here is that, how do I progress down here? So my thesis is that when we look at the COVID-19 epidemic, it illustrates what I call a crisis model for invention and for innovation. And it helps us to rethink IP system in times of crisis, but also thinking about IP systems in what I'll call normal times. Though sometimes I wonder what we mean by normal times after going through what we think about as crisis. And part of the work here that I'm doing is not only simply looking at what we can see in the last 2 years, though the previous presentations have showed us. It's not just simply 2 years. COVID-19 didn't just simply come out of anywhere. And even though the finding of a vaccine was fairly quick, or it seems fairly quick, there were several years, if not decades, of research that went into that process and made that acceleration possible. But there's also a historical aspect of this. And part of the things that I look at in the paper is what we learned from the polio epidemic in the 20th century, and also the AIDS crisis in the 1980s and to a certain extent continuing now. What does that teach us about this sort of innovation process? Is there some sort of a distinct crisis type innovation? And how does that challenge the normal times? Both the polio and the AIDS epidemic are a number of features that are really interesting that I go to in a little bit more detail in the paper. I'll be glad to take a Q&A on. Is that it really challenges sort of the Schumpeterian notion of innovation, where we think about sort of the human mind, usually the mind that's somehow captured in the body of an entrepreneur that works upon the world in a disruptive way to come up with new technologies, you know, maybe usually responding to new markets, new opportunities, and so forth. But what the COVID crisis tells us is there's a really interesting interplay between, you know, what we think about as the entrepreneurial spirit, sort of abstracted in the Schumpeterian sense, and nature. We think about what happened with the COVID crisis as maybe a response to lots of changes in technologies, changes in travel, perhaps looseness in some aspects of public health, and so forth, combined with some sort of institutional structure. So it's sort of an interesting interplay between the mind, nature, and for lack of a better term, I'll use politics. And so some of you may be familiar with some of the literature on famines. Jacques Drez and Amartya Sen have written about development and the notion of famines. And a lot of the notion that comes out of there, especially when you look at the famine in Bengal in 1943 that Professor Sen made famous, is to think about the origin of famine is not so much a sort of a natural phenomenon, but as an example of institutional failure. That the reason we had the famine is because there were certain policy choices made, you know, such as the diversion of food materials to military efforts, the failure of creating distributional mechanisms to meet a demand in rural areas that created the crisis. So the crisis is a product of institutional failure. I'm going to flip that around a little bit to think also about how crisis induces institutions, new types of institutions. And by institutions, I mean not only just simply reforms in the law, but also political movements, the way we think about society, the way we think about social interactions. Certainly in the COVID area, the way we've thought about work is probably the most prominent example. But certainly with the AIDS crisis, the way we think about our sexual relationships, the way we think about the types of relationships among people. Certainly in the polio situation, there are also lots of very interesting questions about drug development, the types of ways in which universities function in terms of the development of drugs. So I'm thinking about institutional change that's coming from crisis in a very broad sense. I want to explore those different dimensions. So this is sort of the broad picture for this. It's not simply looking at crisis as the product of institutional failure, but also how crisis induces institutional change. And certainly this has legal implications. Certainly when we look at the AIDS crisis, there's so much that happened during those decades. But one, you know, maybe seemingly trivial matter was something like Hatch-Waxman and the development of generic drug reform, things about orphan drugs. Those are things that didn't come out of a vacuum either, but certainly the AIDS crisis, so to speak, induced those types of changes. And certainly even with polio, there's lots of ways of rethinking university-industry collaboration that arose. I can go into it, I'll go into it a little bit more in the paper, collaborations between within the United States, the state governments, universities, and the federal government. This is, and not to get too enmeshed in U.S. politics, but you had, at the time of the polio crisis, President Eisenhower doing the famous statement that you often hear in U.S. accounts or U.S. news accounts of U.S. healthcare, President Eisenhower saying, well, I'm not in favor of socialized medicine, but I do think the federal government has to do something here to distribute the polio vaccine. But I'm not a socialist, I'm Eisenhower, but you know, we need to do something. So I mean, that's kind of interesting change that occurred, and there's really a kind of an interesting history that kind of parallels what happened in the U.S. with the COVID vaccine still going on to a certain extent. To what extent do we have federal and state interactions, private initiatives, and so forth? A lot of that gets mirrored in the polio situation. Even the fake news. There was a famous journalist during that period, I think Walter Winchell, who was talking about what is this Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine, and be very careful and so forth. And as people may know, with the polio vaccine, there was some controversy in some sense because he was using a dead virus rather than the live virus. This is the sort of Sabine Salk controversy as far as the nature of the vaccine. And so lots of very interesting parallels that you see. And so I want to abstract from that a little bit for the rest of my talk, but also sort of bring it back down to think about what we can learn from these various crises. And so, of course, you know, what do we think about as the crisis? What is the definition of crisis that I've heard? If you take Schumpeter to the extreme, maybe we're always in crisis. We're always in a period of disruption in some sense. But I have a very more precise notion of crisis here. I'm thinking about stresses on existing institutions for delivering goods and services. And these are stresses that threaten human existence by raising mortality. So I'm looking at crisis in the extreme. And so we can think about, I mean, people may be following a little bit what's happening in the US with baby formula. Is that a crisis? Yes and no. I mean, I think there's definitely a spectrum here that I have within my definition of crisis. Certainly we think about disease as the extreme as a crisis, but other examples would be natural disasters. As a type of crisis, you see that with things like floods, tsunamis, climate change, so forth. Famines, the example I've given before, as well as disease. And we can think about crisis as a type of institutional failure, to go back to Sen and Therese's notion in the development context. But it's not simply a matter of absolute scarcity or absolute abundance. So this is a little bit of an advertisement for myself for some separate research I'm doing on the notion of scarcity and abundance in intellectual property, and I'll be glad to talk about that as well. And so when you think about crisis in these terms, what are the different theories of crisis, right? How do we understand them? And so, you know, we usually think about going back historically to things like Malthusian
and new Malthusian theories of crisis. So these are ones where you have population expanding to not be able to keep up with the food supply. And so you have cycles of feast and famine that lead to the tragedy of commons. These are well-known stories that we're familiar with and may drive some aspects of the policy. But I think these are sort of old-fashioned stories, right? These are ones that don't tell everything about what's happening when we understand crisis, and not a very good and helpful theory of crisis. More modern theories, and again, you know, when you think about Esther Bassarup, a scholar of economic development and induced innovation, as I speak about, we're talking here at least several generations, but it's useful to go back, because there was a challenge to sort of these Malthusian and neo-Malthusian stories that then define a lot of modern theories of innovation. So when we look at Esther Bassarup, the story is something like this. When the population comes up against arable land, there's a shift to labor-intensive technologies. So in other words, we don't just simply have, you know, people dying off, you have a shift in technologies when you have some sort of challenge between the population and the food supply. And so you have a movement to more labor-intensive technologies, and she's looked at the historical tradition in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, where you do see movements of these types of technologies that use the land more intensively, right? So in other words, to try to get more out of the land. And of course, these were based upon scientific understandings at the time. There's a very interesting article in the New Yorker, I don't refer to it in this article, about creating artificial photosynthesis. Really, really fascinating, right? So the way in which we can sort of develop or change the, and you think about the Green Revolution in the 1960s, again, the ways in which we think about using productive technologies more intensively. So these lead to development of new types of infrastructure, and these becomes a basis for what we can think about as sort of neo-institutional schools of economics. We have new institutions that develop. And these are not meant to reduce millennia of history to a PowerPoint or even to a bullet point on a PowerPoint. The idea is to think about this more broadly and then to delve in deeply into the details, but looking at specific case studies as I'm doing in this and other papers. So here we see the story of this post-Malthusian theories of change as ones that go beyond agricultural development. Bassarup was looking at the development in agriculture. But then you think about industrial revolution, post-industrial revolution, information. All of these other things also, in some ways, respond to different types of crises, right? And so this is the theory that I'm trying to move for. And so here we think about theories of sustainability. Work of Neuig, Derwent, and Jaeger kind of lay out, again, a way to think about these types of theories of sustainable and what I call sort of crisis-induced innovation. Right, and so usually there's some sort of a crisis that triggers the need for institutional adaptations. There's systematic failure or learning from the failure and the breakdown. There's then a destabilization of existing institutions. It may not be a complete, you know, revolution, but at least there's a questioning of existing institutions, which then leads to some sort of inevitable decline in the sense of changes in existing institutions. And then some sort of active and reflective decision-making. And I should also say maybe in some stations even reactive decision-making. We need to think about how there might be forces of reaction that try to restore kind of traditional institutions as well. So it's a fairly complex process, and I'll try to give some examples when I look at COVID in a few minutes. But if you think of broader examples, I know there's an interesting paper tomorrow from Peter Yu on wartime, and I've thought a little bit about wartime and IP. There's a lot of interesting technology transfer that occurs during wartime, as well as technology development that occurs during wartime, not to mention, I think, I haven't followed this, maybe others have followed this more deeply, about some of the uses or breaking of patents or challenges to Russian patents in the US, at least, in response to the war in Ukraine that they instituted. And so lots of interesting questions there. Economic instability, you think about things that happened during the Great Depression or the Great Recession or the downturn in 2008. There could be something I'd also include in this notion of crisis, a shift in worldviews, sort of fundamental questioning about religious views, even fundamental questions on the other side of secularism And so those are also things that I would think as more ideological types of crises. And then, of course, just new technologies, things that have just come up that may have occurred serendipitously or exogenously. And so I've done some talk about how this compares with Schumpeter. Let me use my remaining time to sort of illustrate my idea in terms of, well, do we think about COVID then as an example of crisis-induced innovation? This is sort of an unfair question since, you know, we're still sort of at the tail end of the COVID era, if you want to call it that. But of course, there'll be things that come up. But I mean, just to kind of give you an idea of what I'm thinking about here, what are some of the arguments for thinking about COVID as some basis for crisis-induced innovation? One is there were stresses in healthcare delivery. I mean, we still see that to a little bit now in terms of vaccine delivery and so forth. But clearly, you know, we saw that with the PPEs and the challenges to the emergency wards and so forth. And so again, we do have that aspect where this fundamental sort of institution comes up in challenges. There was some learning through the policy responses that occurred in terms of how we think about healthcare delivery. There were then new methods that developed of vaccine development and delivery. And I should also include, you know, methods of distributing and creating PPEs. There's also questioning of the patent system. I mean, sort of institutional legal issues that arose in terms of thinking about right to repair and just generally access to the patent system and limitations on patent rights. And then some degree of active institutional response. Now, I have to admit, I was writing this and thinking about this more about you know, last fall and last summer, where it seems like a lot was more, you know, up in the air. I'm sort of being a little bit more pessimistic now as to whether there has been sort of real fundamental change or not, or whether we're going through a period of reaction. But still, you know, if you think about what may have happened and maybe still ongoing, since we're in the middle of this and to a certain extent, there is a way to think about COVID as an illustration of this induced innovation idea of crisis. But what are the arguments against? One is, of course, that this was just simply a political failure. If we had better political institutions at the time, you know, we think about, you know, Bill Gates now talking about creating some sort of, you know, a rapid response team to pandemics at the global level. And so we have those types of things. And so to wrap up, there are certain arguments to say that this isn't really crisis-induced innovation, that there were just some sort of very specific things that happened. And it was just a perfect storm for bad things to happen. And so I shouldn't be creating all of these elaborate theories. But if it weren't for me creating elaborate theories, I wouldn't have the opportunity to be at wonderful conferences like this and share ideas with it. But beyond that opportunity, I think there is something to think about in thinking about crisis-induced innovation. So I'll just end it there. I do have sort of a research plan that I've alluded to in my discussion, I talk about in the paper, but I look forward to your questions and comments.